It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Federal Health Care Exchange is officially up and running in Wisconsin. But the six agencies responsible for helping people navigate the complex array of private insurance it offers are only just beginning to get the word out to the thousands of people who need to sign up for coverage before the first of next year. In part four of our week-long series on the Affordable Care Act, Gilman Halstead catches up with one of those healthcare navigators to find out how the effort is going so far.
Only one of the six state agencies that received federal navigator funding has actually begun doing what they were funded to do. The other five have gotten federal certification, but they're still working with the Office of the State Commissioner of Insurance to get state certification to allow them to begin counseling and referring people to the plans they're eligible for. Bobby Peterson of the health advocacy group ABC for Health says the state has made it extremely difficult for the navigators to begin their work.
You know, hoops and hurdles that the state of Wisconsin added their own layer of licensing requirements, criminal background checks, fingerprinting, which, you know, slowed down the process and made it really difficult for people to get the help they need.
The Northwest Wisconsin Concentration Employment Program, or CEP, based in Ashland, is the one agency that's completed that process. Marcy Pratt is coordinating the CEP effort, trying to reach as many as 130,000 people in 27 northern counties. She calls the late start a glitch, but her group is now able to use $285,000 grant it received to help the uninsured or underinsured find what they need. She says they'll be doing it through community meetings hosted by a wide range of groups.
The Chamber of Commerce is pulling together partners. The UW Extension is working with us. The libraries are working with us. The local departments of health and social services are working with us. We even have insurance agents that want to assist us, which is good.
Pratt says her task is to reach people who have different insurance needs depending on the size of their family and their health conditions. The goal, she says, is to match a family's income with insurance they can afford. Companies in the exchange are offering five levels of coverage: catastrophic, bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. Each priced differently in different parts of the state.
In the southern part of the state, there might be an insurance company that offers a silver plan at one rate, but they might offer that same plan in the northern part of the state at a different rate.
Finding the right plan without a navigator can be daunting. That's the dilemma Beth Welch of Madison faces. She's the sole breadwinner in the family. Her husband is a stay-at-home dad caring for their three-year-old son. Her son is covered by Badger Care. She's had problems using the federal website to search for plans in the area.
Verifying my identity was very complicated. They weren't able to find my case. And then I was given an email link when I tried again to set up a different username, and that also failed. So I actually haven't been able to confirm what things would cost for my family.
And she's not sure what plan her employer might offer. Businesses are also trying to navigate the new marketplace. Under the law, if her employer offers her a plan with a premium that's less than 9.5% of her income, she has to take it. But the law calculates that percentage based only on the cost of a plan for her, not for her family.
Even if it's 9.5% individual, I still need to cover my husband. So it'll be much, much higher than 9.5% of my income with my husband. So I'll have to do a lot of looking at my budget and seeing what makes sense after that point.
Once the navigators are all up and running in the state, they will be working both with individuals and with businesses to help them choose plans that meet the needs of their employees. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, Northwest Concentration Employment Program is, as we just heard, the only one of the six federally funded state agencies that's been able to begin their work as a navigator here in Wisconsin.
Joining us now from that agency, we have Chief Operating Officer Brad Gingras. Brad, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the goal is for NWCEP?
Yeah, with our project, what we want to do is get as much of the word out about the Affordable Care Act in a very unbiased way throughout the 27 counties that we're working in. We intend to reach in some form 110,000 people, which we understand is an awful lot of people. But through various forms of media, we believe we can do that and just provide the facts about what the Affordable Care Act is and how people can enroll when needed.
Well, what are your methods so far for getting the word out to people?
Well, it's been limited at this point because, as many of the listeners just heard, getting up and running has been difficult, and we've just became licensed recently. So we're just really starting to get the word out right now, which we're going to be doing through a variety of different ways, doing a lot of local outreach, doing workshops and presentations throughout the counties that we are impacting. Mailings will be going out, radio ads if we can do that, and working with as many partners as possible to reach as many citizens as possible.
Why is it, you know, we just heard that NWCEB has been the only one of six agencies with this funding to be navigators that has been able to get up and running. Do you have any idea why that is?
I would say one of the biggest reasons is persistence. Marcia Pratt, who you heard from earlier, we're very fortunate to have her here, but she has a wealth of knowledge about benefits and health insurance already, and so her prior knowledge about some of the departments we're working with, but also just some of the logistics really helped out, and her persistence of and knowledge have helped guide us through. So it did take us longer to get going. We really thought that we might be doing presentations for the public as early as the middle of September so we could kick things off as of October 1st. That wasn't necessarily the case, but we did what we had to do, and we are finally to the point now where we can start reaching the goals of the grant we received.
Well, as you're well aware, I'm sure we're seeing some difficulties with the government's website for the exchanges. How is that affecting your work?
Well, it's unfortunate that the website has been challenging for people. It's out of our control, of course. We recognize there are challenges with that, and we are preaching patience as much as we can. So many of the phone calls we're receiving are people that are frustrated with the website. And the best we can do is help guide them through in as many ways as possible. But also, we want people to understand that, yes, there are glitches right now, whether it's from so many thousands of people accessing the site at one time or whether it's the software. Whatever those challenges are, we believe they're going to get those figured out very, very quickly. The president made statements earlier this week about how he's putting his best people on the project. So as long as we recognize that those flaws are out there, we can help at least guide people through in the best way we can.
What do you most want people to know about the process as they go along?
Well, anytime you're dealing with health insurance, it's a sensitive topic. It's also a topic that can be complicated, and it's human nature that if you are confused or frustrated by a topic, many times learning as much as you can about that can be difficult. So what we want people to understand is there are navigators like us out there that can help with that process, and not to hesitate to call, or more importantly, to go to a local event in your community if you see there's one out there, to educate about the Affordable Care Act and learn as much as you can about health insurance, about the marketplace, and also about the role of navigators, and to learn more about how they can enroll so they can receive the insurance that is best suited for them.
This is also new for everybody, and it seems like we're discovering new things, you know, every day. Do you feel like you know enough to help consumers effectively already?
Yes, I do. As navigators, we've had to go through a substantial amount of training from the federal level to the state level, and I'm glad we did. We have been trained well, and there's consistently new resources coming out, and webinars and trainings and resources that are coming to us from folks within the state or folks at a federal level. And so the resources are there, and also not only that, but strategies for helping to get the word out. And so, yes, I do believe that we know enough. We know what we need to help as many individuals as possible. And we recognize some of those resources are going to continue to change to find new ways to be effective, and we'll continue to learn as much as we can so we can help people more appropriately.
All right. Well, Brad, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Brad Gingras, Chief Operating Officer of Northwest Concentration Employment Program.
Coming up, we'll get inspired about Indian cooking. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, a Wisconsin case is getting national attention and raising issues about the rights of pregnant women.
First, we're talking about cooking Indian food, which, you know, tends to intimidate a lot of people in the kitchen because they assume it'll be complex with lots of spices. But our next guest says it doesn't have to be that way. He's put together a cookbook to serve as a masterclass in Indian cooking. All the recipes use 10 ingredients or less and take about 30 minutes to make.
Raghavan Iyer joins us now. He's a consultant. He's the author of Indian Cooking Unfolded, a masterclass in Indian cooking with 100 easy recipes using 10 ingredients or less. Raghavan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Well, you came, I think, from Mumbai to Minnesota. You didn't learn to cook in India. What was it like learning to cook traditional Indian food here in the Midwest?
Well, in many ways I say Indian Cooking Unfolded is a book that's 30 years in the making. coming from Mumbai, that time, the availability of ingredients in the middle of Minnesota was really next to non-existent. And I experienced firsthand the challenges that, somebody who wished to replicate the flavors of India with simple ingredients was always cumbersome. So, in the process of writing this book, I sort of went back 30 years, and I could emphasize what the average person who wishes to do Indian food goes through.
Well, and that's what a lot of people might think. Indian cooking sounds great, but there's all these wild spices that I can't get around here. Can we do it without having an excellent Indian grocery right next door?
Absolutely. And the whole premise of the book is, Rob, you could actually go to a main grocery store. You wouldn't need to go to an Indian store at all. And in the matter of, researching the book, I traveled all over the country. And I'm one of those who enjoys going to just your neighborhood grocery store. And I would walk up down the aisle of where the spices are, and I would look at the top five spices that I found common in all of these stores. And, spices like cumin, coriander, mustard, turmeric, and cardamom. And this is something that was pervasive. And also, these were spices that I consider, used in Indian cooking all across the subcontinent. And so that was the premise of the book, and coming up with some amazing flavors and the layering of spicing, which is what showcases the beauty of Indian cooking amongst those pages.
And that's a big point in your book. Have those five spices handy. Let me see if I got them: cumin, coriander, turmeric, ginger.
Yeah. Ginger is one of the flavorings, but cumin, coriander, turmeric, mustard, and cardamom.
Mustard and cardamom. Okay. And now how about blending them? Because I'll buy spice mixes in the store, Indian spice mixes. Can we do our own blends at home that are just as good or maybe even better?
Well, I think, it's the latter part. It's a million times better. And I show you, the book has only two blends in it. The majority of it is, when you look at the way the chapters are laid out, every chapter is a lesson plan. And so you don't have to follow the lesson plan from start to finish, but, it starts you off, the first recipe, for instance, in a particular chapter will, have maybe no spice in it or just one spice. And then how do you build upon those layers? And many of those recipes could have within, again, the context of 10 ingredients or less, you could have two or three spices, and the way it's put together or ground or toasted or roasted, that ends up creating a sort of a signature blend or signature flavor for that particular recipe.
When you're cooking with a seed, like a cumin seed or a mustard seed, I'm lazy, I'll buy the powder. Does it make sense to actually get the seed and grind it yourself? Does it make a difference?
Great point, because to me, I always have said in the 22 years of teaching that I've been doing that as much as possible, you should be buying whole spices in the entire seed form. And it's about how can we extract multiple flavors from whole spices. And I talk about it in the book, and I'll give you a 30-second sort of an elevator rundown about, extracting 8 flavors from a given spice. Mm. You mentioned cumin seeds. If it's used whole as is, you get one flavor. If it's ground raw, you get a second flavor. Dry toasted in the seed, you get a third flavor. Ground after it has been dry toasted, you get a fourth flavor. If it's sauteed in some kind of a fat, left in the seed form, you get flavor number 5. If it's ground after it has been roasted in oil, you get flavor number 6. Soaked in a liquid seed form, you get flavor 7. And then if it's ground after it has been soaked in the liquid, you get flavor number 8.
Oh, man. I want to go home and start roasting cumin seeds right now. This sounds great.
But, you know, and the beauty of some of those, of working with those spices, is you could actually take one spice. And, in fact, I've done that with cumin seed. I believe there's an amazing, you know, potato recipe where I cube up Yukon Gold potatoes and I roast them in oil that has been tempered with mustard seeds that I have sizzled. I mean, sorry, cumin seeds. And then it gets nice and golden brown. And then I take raw cumin seeds and I grind it. And I combine that with a little bit of turmeric and cayenne and salt. And that's the flavoring for those potatoes. So you layer those potatoes with the same spice in two different formats.
All right. That sounds great. Can you give us another maybe first try recipe for someone who wants to try Indian cooking but wants a real simple way to step into it?
Every chapter, you know, as you've noticed, opens with a fold-out, mm-hmm. and it's sort of a pictorial representation of, you know, some of the basic recipes. And, you know, one of my favorites actually tends to be in the vegetarian mains chapter. I've got an amazing smoky yellow split peas. You know, we're entering season where you want to have something warm and comforting. And so it's a combination of yellow split peas and potatoes that are, you know, as you can see, potato seems to be a main theme in my repertoire since it's one of my favorite tubers. And you combine the two together with a little bit of turmeric. And once they all cook, you take 3 spices, cumin, coriander, and dried red chilies. You toast them, and then you grind them up with a fresh tomato, and that is the flavoring for those for that pot of yellow split peas and potatoes. Rich, you know, comforting. It is vibrant, but it's also the beauty about it is that dish has no fat in it. It has no added oils, but yet the flavors that you sample that come from that particular recipe is just incredible. And of course, not to mention, pitifully simple.
All right. Well, let's get some fat in the recipe now. Can you talk to me about ghee? This is a purified or clarified butter, right? And we can make our own.
Yeah. And I've always said, you know, if you can melt butter, you can make ghee. It's not rocket science. And if you melt unsalted butter over a very low heat source and you keep skimming off you know, the foam and the milk solids, and some of the milk solids will eventually settle to the bottom. And while you get to that point, which takes about 10 or 15 minutes, really, and no labor, extra labor on your part, the liquid that's left behind is a liquid that resembles very much like a light amber-colored oil. But with that clarification process, what you've done, and by removing the milk solids, and we strained the whole product, by the way, for cheesecloth, and you end up with a product that is extremely rich and nutty tasting, and it also removes the need to refrigerate it because you remove the milk solids. There's no reason to refrigerate it anymore. And the other big reason is you also have increased the smoke point of butter in a way, because you can't deep fry in butter, but you get rid of the milk solids. You can actually deep fry in ghee, and it's sort of, I was saying, an Indian's way of prolonging the shelf life of butter.
And that's why it was invented, in part, right?
Absolutely. It's the purity of it, and it's, you know, it's a product of the cow, and sometimes, of course, water buffalo as well. And and it's used not only in cooking, but it's also used in some of the religious functions especially among Hindus in India.
All right, and then you just fry your veggies and other ingredients in the ghee.
You could, you know, and sometimes I love the taste, but if you don't want to have that fat, I'll stir fry something with a little bit of oil, canola oil, for instance, and then towards the end, I will just swirl in one to two teaspoons of the clarified butter. And so what you end up getting is that intense burst of the flavor of ghee without the fat, the added fat. And so that, I think, makes it extremely extremely delicious.
So in our last 30 seconds or so, my favorite way to cook is to just kind of wing it. If I go mm-hmm. through the book, do I have to keep coming back to the recipes? Or do you think I'll have the education I need to just make up my own Indian recipes?
I think you'll have the education to completely wing it. That's the beauty of Indian cooking, really, is once you know the basics, the knowledge of how and how to use those spices, I think you will end up with the fortitude and the ability to do it without a cookbook. But of course, you do need Indian cooking unfolded for that.
Raghavan, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it. That was Raghavan Iyer. He's consultant, author of Indian Cooking Unfolded. He's left me inspired and hungry.
Coming up next, it's the news. Then we're talking to an advocate for pregnant women about a federal case focused on the rights of pregnant women.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A case filed this month in Milwaukee dealing with the protection of a fetus versus the rights of a mother is gaining national attention.
A pregnant woman was taken into custody after telling her doctor that she had been addicted to pain medication the year before her pregnancy.
The Wisconsin law that allowed for her detention exists in four states in the country. The group National Advocates for Pregnant Women is challenging it as unconstitutional in a federal district court in Milwaukee.
Here with us to talk about the case is Eric Eckholm. He wrote an article on the case in today's New York Times. And later in the show, we'll be joined by the executive director of National Advocates for Pregnant Women. Thank you for joining us, Eric.
Good afternoon.
Well, who is Alicia Beltran? Let's start there.
Well, she's a 28-year-old woman, lives in Jackson. She'd worked as a bartender and a waitress, living with her father, had a boyfriend, got pregnant. And when she went for her prenatal care, she thought she was being helpful by telling her doctor about her past, that last year for a few months she had become addicted to an opiate painkiller, but she, working with her parents, interestingly, had kicked the habit, actually had withdrawal and was hospitalized, and since then had on her own been taking a drug that's used in drug treatment programs to help wean people off that dependency or desire. And she had actually phased that out. She'd done it on her own, not under supervision, but she said she had phased it out a few days before this visit. And apparently the physician's assistant who examined her was suspicious or didn't believe her.
Did she volunteer the information about the previous addiction, or was it something that was asked?
I don't know how it came about, but she has always been very open about it. She had seen another doctor before and given the whole story, so it was all in her record.
Now, ultimately, it sounds like a social worker showed up at her door with an action plan, and it didn't go well from there. What happened?
She was first, at the medical examination. She said, "This is crazy. I've already gotten off that drug, and I don't want to put the fetus through that again." And the doctors were quite alarmed by this. And then 2 weeks later, a child welfare social worker shows up at her door unannounced and says, "Look, you need to go into a treatment plan or we're going to get a court order to force you." And she admits she lost her temper. You know, she said, "Look, you know, I've already done this. Go away," and shut the door on the woman. Then 2 days later, the county sheriff showed up and they took her away in handcuffs.
Do you have a sense of how often this may have happened? You know, different circumstances for every case, but how often this may have happened in Wisconsin and these other three states that do this?
Well, I don't know about the other states. In Wisconsin, this was passed in 1998, and there have been most of these are very confidential because it's handled within the child welfare system, which is a confidential, non-criminal, supposedly, kind of approach. But there have been anecdotal stories told by obstetricians or wants to do what's best, and they easily could have. And there are treatments for addiction and for newborns who come from an addicted mother. So There was, in their view, a very exaggerated sense of the danger and a rather unproductive approach, which only scares other women away from telling their doctor the truth.
Do you know what the healthcare facility had to say about it, about why they ended up going this route?
Well, they have refused to talk. You know, there's now a lawsuit, and possibly more will come, and they have confidentiality requirements. A spokesman for the hospital just said, we are confident that our staff acted on good faith. So it's possible that this physician's assistant and doctor had a genuine, it's probable, you know, they really feared there was something life-endangering to, as they put it, the unborn child. But the facts don't seem to bear that out. But we haven't, you know, we haven't fully heard the other side yet.
Now, you said that there is a pending case on this, which will be heard in federal court in Milwaukee. Do you have a sense of what's at stake here legally?
Well, your next guest can talk about that in more detail since she helped bring the case. But it's an effort to not just throw out this supervision of Ms. Beltran, but to declare the entire law unconstitutional. It's an infringement on liberty, privacy, and various civil rights of a pregnant woman. And if this case seems like a particularly bad, not very thoughtful application of the law, then that only proves the point that it's vague and potentially misused. But this would be probably an important precedent that other states often don't have a specific law, but they try to use their child welfare systems to pressure women into drug treatment. And then a few states, a number of states, have used criminal laws. And in Alabama, when a newborn tests positive for drugs, a number of women have even gone to prison. So this isn't going to resolve the issue for the whole country, but it would be one step toward turning things around, perhaps.
All right. Well, Eric, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Eric Eckholm with the New York Times. And Lynn Paltrow joins us now. She's the executive director of National Advocates for Pregnant Women. Lynn, thank you for joining us. Hi there, Lynn. Could you tell us how frequently women are detained in Wisconsin for reasons like in the case of Alicia?
As Eric Eckholm pointed out, perhaps one of the many scary things about the law is that they gave the state power over pregnant women through all stages of pregnancy by adding language and amending their children's code. And children's codes are typically extremely confidential. And so that means that you have an incident where you have the state, under this statute, a law enforcement officer can take a pregnant woman into custody just based on his or her belief that she's had too many drinks or even had one drink. And it's not a public record. The woman herself is not entitled to counsel at her first proceeding. And so we simply don't know how many cases there are like this. There was one that received a great deal of press involving another woman who went to a Wisconsin hospital saying, "I have developed an addiction to opiates. Please help me." And while one part of the hospital staff was doing exactly that and setting up methadone treatment for her, somebody else in the hospital saw her as unworthy of treatment and needing to be under state control and surveillance, reported her to the state. Sheriffs came, took her to a mental hospital 2 hours away from her husband and her two-year-old, where she languished for 10 days before she was brought in front of a judge, at which point it was clear she had received zero prenatal care and had been given Xanax while she was being held in the mental hospital.
Now, according to Eric's article, Alicia, when she initially appeared in court, wanted to know where her lawyer was and was found that her fetus had a legal guardian. Can you talk a little bit about that, about why she wasn't given legal representation?
I don't know what was in the minds of the people who passed this law. I can only say that it is a statute that really makes very clear that upon becoming pregnant, women in Wisconsin lose their civil rights, that it's really pretty much every right that we associate with constitutional personhood was denied to Alicia Beltran. Her 12-week fetus gets a lawyer. She's not entitled to a lawyer. She can be taken into physical custody for months without necessarily having a hearing, and without even clear and convincing evidence that anything she's doing is worthy of being deprived of her liberty. So it's something that people should be very concerned about, that much authority is being delegated to a social worker, a police officer, and even physicians who, as the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse note, most of whom lack the basic education in addiction medicine that's needed to make proper judgments about what kind of services people need.
Now, that was the law we're talking about came into being in 1998. Do you know what the idea behind that law was initially to protect the fetus from harm is what I'm assuming?
Certainly that has been one of the explanations. There was a case in Wisconsin in which a woman was receiving prenatal care, and that's what we all want. We want women to be connected to health care, wherever they can enter that system, because that will give them the opportunity to be healthy and to have the healthiest possible pregnancies. Her physician believed she was using cocaine. He told her to stop, as if people who genuinely have addiction problems can just stop. And when she was not immediately obedient, able to overcome her addiction, and people who smoke cigarettes know how hard any addiction is to overcome, he reported her to child welfare, and child welfare began child welfare proceedings and took custody of her fetus and ordered it into treatment. She challenged that use of the law. She won, and the response of the state legislature in Wisconsin was not to increase access to prenatal care, to create a system of single-payer health insurance to make sure all pregnant women can afford it. It wasn't to ensure that there was all the treatment that families need. Instead, they rewrote the Children's Code and added the term unborn child over 400 times and gave the court authority over pregnant women at all stages of pregnancy.
Right now we're talking to Lynn Paltrow, founder and executive director of National Advocates for Pregnant Women.
We want to hear what you think about this. Do you think there are cases where the state should intervene and maybe even detain pregnant women to ensure the health of the fetus? Where do you draw the line, if so, or do you think it's a bad idea? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking now with Lynn Paltrow, founder and executive director of National Advocates for Pregnant Women, talking about a recent case in Wisconsin where a woman was detained. She was sent to jail after admitting at a prenatal visit that she had formerly been addicted to painkillers. And we're talking about the case that's ensuing now. It will be heard in federal court in Milwaukee.
You can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org, with your thoughts on this.
Now, Lynn, before we go too much farther, you are handling this case, and I would like to know where you see it going, and what do you see as being at stake here?
Well, we are co-counsel on the case. Lead counsel is Wisconsin attorney Linda Vandenhoevel, and we're doing it with the Reproductive Justice Clinic at New York University School of Law. But this case is very important. I mean, what happened to Alicia Beltran is what we're seeing increasingly around the country, where claims that fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses have separate rights, completely separate legal rights, not moral value, but separate legal rights, is being used to intervene, to arrest, detain, and force medical treatments on pregnant women that ultimately are not only a violation of their human rights, but it's bad for babies. Every leading medical group in this country, from the American Medical Association to the American Academy of Pediatrics, says, don't respond to pregnancy and pregnant women as if they're criminals, as if they're bad. this is a health situation, and as a just and sane society, we respond by providing health care. The state's role shouldn't be to empower people to say, do what I say, even if it's medically wrong, or I'll arrest you. The state's role should be to do things like fully implement the Affordable Care Act and make sure people have access to treatment. So this is an opportunity to bring attention to a particular law that we believe is used much more frequently than people know. But it also represents something that's happening across the country, and it isn't just around pregnant women who may use an illegal drug. A few months ago in Florida, a woman who went for a prenatal care visit near the end of her pregnancy, she had had several previous cesarean surgeries, went home. She was planning to come back. It was a Tuesday, to come back on Friday for cesarean surgery to deliver her fifth wanted child. And she had an email from her doctor saying, if you don't come in tomorrow, our staff feels like you need to come in tomorrow, and if you don't, I'm going to be forced to send police to your house to come get you. So we have this terrible distortion of healthcare in this country in which the anti-abortion claims that fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses should be treated separately are being used to punish and promote punitive policies towards pregnant women. These are not issues of women's rights versus fetuses' rights. These are issues of the health and well-being of pregnant women and their future children versus improper use of state power.
Let's go to the phones now. I want to take a call. We have Joe on the line from Madison. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I would just like to comment that that actually happened to me. I had gotten pregnant and went in for my prenatal care and had mentioned to the doctor that I had previously smoked marijuana before I got pregnant and that I had quit. And she nodded it off like it was nothing, you know, just went on with it. And then the day I had my baby, they sent in a social worker to come take custody of him. And I had no pre-knowledge that it was a problem or anything, and I was really appalled. They took his first poopy diaper to test it for THC, and if it would have came back positive, they would have took him right then and there from me and, like wouldn't even let me see him once the social worker came in there, like he needs to go into the nursery. So I was just freaking out, and when it came back negative, of course, then they were like, oh, sorry about that. And I even asked the social worker if I had been drinking a gallon of vodka every day, if she would have been there. Hmm. And she said, no, that's legal. We're just concerned because this is an illegal drug.
Okay.
And I was just really upset and wanted to just leave. I didn't feel comfortable there. I didn't want any nurses helping me once I had my baby. I didn't want to let him out of my arms, and I demanded to be released from the hospital. And then they finally went through a bunch of hoops, were going to let me out of the hospital, but they wouldn't let me take my baby. And I was like, well, I'm not leaving without my baby, so I had to wait for the 24-hour period for him to get out. But like then after, I didn't even want to go back to the doctors because I didn't trust them. That was just so horrible for me. And like, I didn't go back to the doctor for 5 years when I got pregnant with my next baby, and I was probably about 6 months along before I even went into the doctors because I was scared to go. I didn't know where to go to.
All right. Well, thank you, Joe. And that's something that has been raised about whether this law might actually deter women from getting the care that they need. What would you say to that, Lynn?
Oh, well, that's exactly right. And I'm so sorry for that woman's experience. I think increasingly women, we get all kinds of emails at National Advocates for Pregnant Women from women who are saying they're being threatened. They're terrified that based on the fact that they may have used a drug or that they're using prescription drugs that might test as if they're criminalized drugs, that they will, instead of having a beautiful birth experience and feel safe and supported, that they are going to be faced with a threatening social worker, somebody accusing them of hurting their babies, and are frightened. I think it's very important to say that there are lots of things that can make pregnancies healthier or unhealthier. I myself am a nicotine baby. The evidence of statistical potential harm from smoking cigarettes is significant. But that doesn't mean in any particular case a pregnant woman who can't quit smoking is actually harming her baby or wants to harm her baby. And the truth is that carefully constructed, unbiased scientific research has not found that prenatal exposure to marijuana or any of the illegal drugs causes unique or even inevitable harm. So this focus on them and this using it as an excuse essentially to terrorize pregnant women and undermine families is not something that's actually advancing family values or protecting children. It's endangering them.
All right. Well, I want to thank Joe so much for calling. And let's go next to Mark in Oconomowoc. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon. I'm going to give you an opinion that I don't think we're doing enough. If we're going to incarcerate, basically, or make wards of the state pregnant women for illegal drugs, perhaps we have research that shows that eating non-organic food that has pesticides and herbicides could also affect our unborn child. So we better lock them up as well. And maybe you're overweight, and that's a theory of gestational diabetes. Or maybe you don't work out and exercise enough to have a healthy baby. Or you don't strap on the headphones and listen to Mozart and enrich your child's life. Eventually, what we can do is we can have all pregnant women put into a housing by the state, which would lead us to the next slippery slope to say if you're born female with all the eggs that you'll ever deliver in your life, that's all potential life, too.
Okay, thanks, Mark, for the call. And, you know, Mark talking about a slippery slope there. Are you concerned about that same slippery slope, Lynn?
Well, I think that's kind of ironic to ask that question because we're already at the bottom of that slope. When you have a woman who seeks extremely early prenatal care because she's so conscientious and she cares so much about her pregnancy, and she shares, you know, helpful information with her doctors, and she obviously loves the idea of becoming a mother and having a healthy baby, and she is taken into custody by 5 police officers, put into handcuffs, and even shackles around her ankles, and has to stand up in front of court alone and be taken into custody and arrested. That is the bottom of the slippery slope, and it's time for people to stand up and say, this is not we have to stop the claims that are being made within the abortion debate, within the so-called personhood measure movement, and understand that the question isn't about when we should lock up pregnant women or deprive them of their rights, but how we're going to value and ensure that every pregnant woman has access to all of the reproductive health care and maternity care she needs.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Lynn Paltrow, founder and executive director of National Advocates for Pregnant Women.
Now it's time for the news. Then we'll speak with the president of the Wisconsin Library Association about the role libraries play today. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.